So welcome, welcome everyone, welcome. This is the closing talk of the series of Birthing the Heart that's been going on now since January 2014. And it's the 25th talk in the series, I counted them. It's kind of a conclusive talk. It doesn't try to sum up all the other 24 talks, but it tries to put a direction to those talks. And the talks have really been about accessing something in us that is very intrinsic, natural, ordinary, and valid, true. The spiritual journey can camouflage the proximity of the truth of the heart. It doesn't need to, but often it does. And the reason it does is that we extend ourselves into the development of the very qualities that are intrinsic to us. And when we do that, we confuse the issue. Now, if you think of a minute, the image of ourselves is really the distorting factor of reality. It's like a veil that we have placed over reality. We don't realize there's a veil. We see through the veil and it all looks proper and oriented, and everyone around us claims to be seeing the same things we do. So it's a common consensual veil, and yet it's a veil nonetheless. And the reason that we find ourselves within a spiritual pursuit and practice and journey is because we sense that there's something wrong with the way we have undertaken life, the way we have aligned and directed ourselves to it, that there's just some coarseness about it, some friction. And that, of course, is because of the veil that we have extended over. Now, the whole of the spiritual journey is to remove that veil. And the veil is an image of ourself. It's the thought that we are central to our location and central to our position in the world, and that all of reality sort of comes in funnel-like into this sense of me. And as long as we carry that perception, everything we do validates that perception. And much of our spiritual practice does just the same thing. We work hard, we put a lot of effort in, we try to manage the way we're seeing by different applications of principle and practice. And yet, as long as we're at the center of the manipulating and effort that is going on, and even if it's directed in terms of the altering of that veil, if we're at the center of that altering project, then the veil will sustain itself. It's self-reinforcing. As long as there's a me, there's going to be a veil. As long as I try hard to uplift that, to unravel that veil, you can be assured that the veil is going to extend itself well into the future. So that's the problem. The fix is that we are naturally what we seek. And this is, I think, where many spiritual teachings go a little astray, and that they keep working on the sense of self, pushing the veil forward, hoping there's a rip in the veil, a tear in the veil. But the real, I think, value is to first see ourselves in the natural state that we are. And the heart, the series that we've been working under, is the revelation that these qualities that we're seeking so desperately for are here, that we just have to know how to access them. And the whole of the series has been a way to nurture that access, to encourage that access, to incline ourselves towards that access. And it does take an inclination. You have to want it, in other words. But then you have to learn to work with it properly so that you're not confused within the distortion process and in the working with it. And so that's what I want to really speak about tonight, is that you know, how is it that we can get so entangled in all of the different ways we practice and feel so distant from something that's so close? Said differently, how is it that we can appear to be outside of the living situation? That life is something happening to us, that it's not, we're not really in there with life, that it's something that's kind of like we're a bystander to the living experience. It's the same problem. What we want to do is enter the living experience, unfiltered, right? Now, when I say it that way, it feels a little bit more dangerous than when I talk about entering the heart, you see. Entering the heart feels like a warm bath. Everybody wants the love and the tenderness and the kindness and the generosity of spirit that the heart holds. But when I talk about entering life, just entering it on its terms rather than our terms, when it's on our terms, then that's the descent of the veil upon life. But on its terms is the removal of that veil and the living life for itself. Then it gets a little bit prickly. I'm not sure, you know, that this is trustworthy. I'm not sure that I can just give myself over. I've had many historical scars. People have treated me in one way or another. And I don't have a lot of trust that just releasing myself into life is going to be the answer to my spiritual quest. And so we sort of remain outside of life. We want the good part of it. We want the heart side of it, but we don't want the living side of it. The problem is that those two are one and the same thing. You can't have the heart without the life, because life, unobstructed life, life that's not veiled, that's not distorted, is the heart. So now what do I do? Well, let's look, because I want to make this practical, and I want to allow us to feel like there's some way that we can begin that process of living life, living the truth, not just having the truth known to us, not just being wise, but living wise. I'm trying to make it an active verb, something that is totally engaged, that we are abiding within rather than having a theory or an intellectual idea about. And that's where this talk is going. But first of all, we have to understand, we have to hear how abstract the problem is. We have to be able to know when we sense somebody is living that and when they're not, and when they're preaching as opposed to participating. Now, all of us have had the experience of a minister or a priest or somebody in a very demonstrative voice, often loud and sometimes even angrily, talking about Jesus in a very boisterous way, and you sense there's something off there. You sense that the voice doesn't replicate the teaching, that the person who's offering the sermon is not living the subject, and it's pretty clear to most of us that is happening, because you can hear the contention within the tone that is being offered. So you might ask, which I did when I was a young boy, now where is the living Christ here? That's the intellectual Christ. That's he's telling us what we should all do, but I don't see him doing it. I don't see him, the minister in this particular case, abiding within that. Christ and Buddha must be found within the living. I think Christ actually said that, let the dead take care of themselves, I don't know, whatever. But the point is that this is a living sense of life. We have to match the philosophy with the living. And we're not so good at that. I think I read somewhere where 90% of what someone does is how we assess them, and only 10% of what they say is believed. So if your actions, as the cliche goes, speaks much more profoundly than the words we speak. And this is really an action. This is really a life that we're talking about. This is a bodily integration, so that the teachings come into the body and bypass the system of evaluation or hedging or pondering or questioning whether this is the right moment in order to do. It's more of an offering into the natural, into the spontaneous. And the question is, so how do we get from into that particular authentic pose and integration? Because I'm usually carrying around the problem in my head. I'm thinking about what I need to do and where I need to go and where I need to be. And all of that puts a kind of an odd twist upon the living truth of the Buddha, the living truth. And so how do we do that? I'm tired of hearing people shout their way to the truth, so it's not through being demonstrative, it's not through antics that we get that. And we have to realize that we can't force our way in. We can't, we can't have an anger or a reactive fit about what we want here. We have to do this with more subtle realization. And so the first thing we really realize when we're entering the body is that this is a realized living, not an intellectual living. This is not something I can think my way into. This truth has to be seen in direct contact, not in some philosophical basis. And that's not the way we've learned how to live in this culture. We've learned our lives and our education through a system in which intellectualization gives us the prominence, gives us the advantage, not the realization. Realization isn't given much credit for anything. And so in this case, it's the opposite, as you might consider the fact that if we're going to move with the veil, then you're going to be seeing from a distorted perception of intellectualization. If you remove the veil and you have to enter life, you can't have a ponderance about what you're going to do. You just have to enter it. There's a kind of surrender or release that's needed, not a holding back and a questioning. And so that's an important, very important. And I want to give you a sense of some of the ways that students come to me. And sometimes very senior students, with questions that show how they've been practicing. For instance, this question was one that a student posed. I have been practicing many years, and as I age, many people are dying. How has my practice prepared me for death? That took me back. I mean, I, my own sense is that all of practice is about death. It's all about release and letting go. But if we haven't been practicing from that vantage point, if we haven't been realizing where this practice directs us, then we will have an intellectual cognitive sense of the practice, we'll have the experience of the practice, but we won't have any sense that this has anything to do with what's the changing quality of life, the nature of loss, the nature of bereavement, of grief, or of death itself. And I asked this person, I said, how have you been practicing that you have missed this point? And she said, well, I've been watching my mind. And I responded, well, when you watch your mind, is there anything stable there? And she said, no, there's nothing stable. I said, then that is what the practice is teaching you. That is the truth. That is the realization. What you have to do is give yourself over to that living truth. In other words, you're having the experience of the mind not settling anywhere, not fixed anywhere. Now get up from your practice and live an unfixed life. So you're not fixing anywhere. So that you live in accordance to the disposition of the way things are, rather than having the experience of practice go one direction and your life go another. These things have to parallel one another. Now, I offer that as a challenge to each one of you. You know, how are you practicing? Is your practice showing you some quality or nature of life, some characteristic of life that we are not accompanying, that we are not joining, that we are not living? And if you look just beneath the surface of whatever you're doing, you'll find that there are these characteristics, these qualities of that your practice are showing you, that you're just having the experience of, but parting ways with as soon as you get up from your meditation. That's not what this is about. This is about seeing, and when you're seeing, quite likely, when you're seeing life in that kind of close proximity, when you're seeing life different than the way you have believed it to be your whole life, quite likely you're piercing the veil in that moment and seeing it more clearly than you will when you're just thinking about it. Okay, and whenever there is an opportunity to pierce the veil and see what's behind there, what the living quality of life really is, that's an indication of the direction we need to take in terms of our life, in terms of our living experience, in terms of our actions. This is what's called wise action. Not a ponderance about what the Buddha said and how I should train myself to live in alignment with his philosophy. That's just more of the same action. He may be wise, but we're not when we're employing that method. We want the wisdom by entering into, by joining that very fabric, that very experience of living. And most of us, that's not where we want to go, because in some ways, as I mentioned early on, we'd rather have the heart without the living. We want the benefits, we want the good stuff, but to surrender over to the chaos or the confusion of impermanence, to surrender over to the fact that that intellectualization of life really has a very limited impact upon the true direction of life. For instance, all of us know that our thoughts are not to be believed. And I was going to say some of our thoughts, but really, none of your thoughts. And if you really take that in, and you see how confusing they are, how distorted they are, how they keep presenting a reality that's off kilter, you think, why do I even need them? What advantage do they give me? They do give some advantage. They give a functional advantage. You have to be able to move and manipulate and maneuver the world, through the world. You have to be able to remember the knowledge base that you have so you can do your job. So the nature of those thoughts have their point, but not to be directed by our thinking, to be informed by our thinking, but not be directed by them. But how many of us really allow thoughts to have that kind of representation? Mostly they just take us wherever they go. And yet we know that they're not the full truth, the complete truth of anything. And especially spiritually, they don't hold any truth. Spiritually, functionally they do, but spiritually, profoundly, and the depth of where spiritual goes, they don't. And yet we just give ourselves over to them. We don't even pause and ask ourselves, is this thought insane? Because if you ever did, you would likely see that most of them are. They drive you insane. So, again, where's the juice here? Where's our practice leading us? Now, I have another person who comes to me frequently with a persistent problem that's always looks to me whenever he comes to me like stress-induced. And so over the years, he's come to me many times, and I've often suggested that it may be stress-reduced, and he says, I know that already. But he doesn't know that. He doesn't know that. And whenever we speak together and I try to bring him down to the level of stress so that he can actually feel what's causing the pain in his body, he won't go there. So there's something there that there's a disconnect. And that's fine. He can take his time getting there. But he went to 50 different healers all over the country and comes back and says, you're right, it's stress reduced. And I said, you know, you could have saved yourself a lot of money by just accessing that and saying, you know, this may be stress reduced, just to consider that possibility rather than just dismiss it because you already knew that. And I run into this, I already know that label many, many times because there's an intellectual understanding of what's going on, but the emotional ambivalence, the emotional element is often missing entirely. And the reader, we can know this intellectually, but that doesn't touch the emotional maturity that has to occur in order for there to be a realization of that very experience. In other words, you can know that you have a belief about yourself that's untrue. You know that. You've seen it. You know it. But until you touch the emotion that binds you to that assumption, the intellect has nothing at all to say about the healing process. It's the maturity of actually seeing and feeling the emotion itself and healing through awareness to that emotion that will bring those two together so that there is an actual realization that I'm being compelled by this emotion and not just knowing it. I just know it. You see, as we get more aware, choices, we begin to see patterns that we have lived with and bad choices we have made. And this produces a lot of guilt, often a lot of shame, a lot of sense of, I just need the forgiveness. But the point is that we're waking up out of the veil that we have been stuck behind. And as we do that, but we now have new choices we can make. And with new choices, with the ability to make choices that are more conscious, comes greater responsibility. We can't just assume the old style of behavior where we had no responsibility because we weren't conscious enough to even know that we could have a choice about anything. We were just following lockstep in accordance with our conditioning. A good example is prejudice. Prejudice just is a lockstep. We've been taught it. We never consider it. We don't consider the emotional ambivalence we have around the subject. We don't allow ourselves to renew, have a new acquaintance with it. We just follow it. Now, at some point, as we wake up, as we become more conscious, we begin to consider those conditional absolutes that we have lived with our whole life. Oh, he's this way, she's that way. Of course they are. They look this way, they look that. Now comes a responsibility. First, you have to make a choice and say, okay, so I don't want to feel that way about groups just because they're in a certain ethnicity or a certain style of life. I want to wake up out of that. Okay, that's a conscious choice to move beyond our conditioning. And that, again, comes from our intentionality. Now, once we have that and we're willing to wake up to it, and we begin to see that we have lived irresponsibly to within that habit, and now we have other choices to make when that same group of people, we're approached by them or they come within our view or whatever it is, and you feel that old stirring again, now you have a new responsibility towards that stirring that you never had before when you're just conditioned and unconscious. So there's a kind of responsibility that being conscious brings with it. An important responsibility to life. Being integritous is part of that responsibility. Knowing where we are, what we're doing, what we're not doing, not just pretending that, you know, it's all the same and kind of going through life in sort of a cloud and confused. But you find yourself being accountable in ways you never were. That's what consciousness does. And the implications, the ramifications of doing something illicit when you're conscious is much greater than when you're unconscious. When you're unconscious, you had no choice. When you're conscious and you have choices and you still go in accordance with the old pattern, then the implication of that, the karmic implication of that, is much greater. Makes sense, doesn't it? We have a choice to make. We chose the wrong way. Before, there wasn't a choice. Now, Nisargadatta, one of my teachers, sort of offered me this path of living Dharma. He was giving me all this teaching, I was totally confused by what he was saying, and I didn't, you know, he's like yelling at me half the times, and I didn't, like, I could barely stay because I was feeling so miserable. And he said, and then finally he sort of cleared it up. He said, listen, this is what I want you to do. Just live the truth and the rest will follow. I said, live the truth? I thought I was. And of course I wasn't. But what he was asking me to do is, prior to the realization, live it. Live the truth. Evoke it. And then embody it. Incline the body, the mind towards it, and then embody it. And even if it doesn't feel right, still do it anyway. Because insight, we have an insight, and it rests in our cognitive frame of reference. You know, oh, I saw this, it gets excited about it, we love it, you know. But we're not living it. We've contained it in our mind. In fact, we've created an artificial division between the mind and the body. And we do that partially so that we can delay having to integrate it. We can postpone it. I'm not quite ready for the action that's necessary that this insight gave me. And so we keep it kind of corridored up in the intellectual mind where we're fascinated by it, exciting and wonderful, but we're not allowing it to come down into our action. We're not allowing it to be embodied so that it actually changes our direction or changes a particular way that we are within life. And I think it's very important now for us to stop screaming about it in an exciting, it's like the preacher who's preaching the gospel but is living far away from that, being a representative of it. We have to start letting this insight into our body. And at first it doesn't come naturally, and we don't even know how to do that. But we can begin to get a sense of the direction that insight can take. Many people, for instance, and I've told this story before, on retreats they have tremendous insights about maybe their living situation or their relationships or what they need to do to heal something. But the problem is, I'll see them next year at the same time and they won't have done a thing. And they'll have that same insight occur the following year and the following year after that, and there hasn't been any movement at all in the life towards the resolution of the problem that the insight revealed. This is a time now, you know, we're not getting any younger. This is when we have to sort of stand courageously within our body and move in a direction that may feel a little upsetting to us. Remembering that we are releasing, what it means to live the insight is that we're releasing the conditioning that has held us back. We're allowing ourselves to move in a new way, and that's scary. I acknowledge the fact that it takes courage to move in a new direction, away from the patterns that have formed our life. But if we stay arrested within the patterns, then we stay arrested far away from the insight. And the Dharma now is a living Dharma. The Buddha has to be alive to us, not something that was 2,500 years ago and which we have to dust off the pages to listen to. This is a live Dharma. And again, I ask you, what do you know to be true about your life that you're not living? What adjustments need to be made from what you've already seen? If we want the heart to be integrated into our life, we have to start moving in the direction of wise view. Wise view is the view of the Dharma prior to its full realization. Interconnectedness. I need to move according to the consciousness that the Dharma is addressing. So when I come in the door and people are sitting, I need to move in relationship to the consciousness that people are sitting, to be inclusive, not just individually determined, not just selfish in my movement. What's the consideration here? What's the broader perspective of this? I mean, it can be as simple as that. It can be as simple as considering your spouse or listening to your spouse or driving home this evening in a different direction. Doing something deliberately to throw you off from the milk horse mentality of knowing exactly where you're going every step of the way. To start allowing something new and fresh coming in. Letting the practice actually reveal where it is we're stuck. And then determining that the way to unstick this is to act counter to it. To do something in opposition to the way we're stuck. Every time somebody gets angry or there's a discussion that's uncomfortable for me, I run away. Okay, so that's where I'm stuck. So now I'm going to sit there in an uncomfortable discussion and just listen. And not have my old historical issues arise about how unsafe I am when I'm an adult and I can say no and I can listen to uncomfortable conversations. I don't have to run here. You see, the mind is coming at us this constantly from the past. It's showing us how we have lived. That's all it will ever show us. Insight is showing us how we could live. And we are denying the insight and living in accordance to how the mind has patterned ourselves from day one. It doesn't get easier to keep siding with the past over the present. It only gets harder because the past keeps replicating itself with more momentum. So what am I going to do, you see? Do I want to live the Dharma or do I want to be a Dharma student all my life? So this sense of heart integration, this 25 talks we've done, let us move from the kind of the overreaching view of interconnectedness, which is the wise view of the way the Dharma is, the way life is, set some intentionality to move in accordance with that as opposed to my own selfish needs, and start moving the body in relationship to that greater understanding than to the distortion of the veil that protects me from it. And the second way I would really encourage us to move so that we begin freeing the body up, begin allowing ourselves to live moment-to-moment Dharma rather than having Dharma as a resource when we are in need or in trouble, is to let our actions be both quantitative and qualitative. Now let me explain what I mean. Usually they're one or the other. We have a Saturday off, we go for a hike. It's wonderful to be out in the woods. It's a qualitative experience. We hear the birds, you know, we're living in nature, we love the mountain air and the fresh smells. So that's the qualitative life. And we seek an alternative environment often. Some of the hikes or surrounding mountains or lakes or rivers to have that experience. And then there's the quantitative life we live, which is made of speed and duration and productivity and the hard tasks of life and the accumulation of goals and the burdens and stressors that a quantitative life will produce on any work, on anyone who's at work. Okay, so I'm not suggesting one as opposed to the other. I'm suggesting letting those two meet. So that as we're moving unconsciously in the world, we begin to question, taking some pauses, saying, wait a second here. My whole morning has been about speed. Okay, all I wanted to do is get the job done. I could care less how the job was done or how many, all I'm interested in is checking off the next job I have to do. So instead of doing that, let me try a different tactic here. Let me see if I can sense the speed, the issue of speed and propulsion. And let me just not surrender myself to that speed. Let me move as quickly as I need to get the job done, to get the day thoroughly finished, so that I won't have somebody, you know, that's unpleased with my work. But let me not be driven by the speed element here. And I begin to feel myself tense up with the speed and I just relax. I'm not going to follow that. I'm not going to do it. I slow down a little bit. What you'll find is that your effectiveness is proportionate to your willingness to slow down and be free of the speed. Right? You may get more things accomplished, but you won't get them as accomplished as well. And so, if you release the need to have to do a number of things and come back into the fold so that you're bringing a qualitative awareness to what you're doing, I guarantee you won't have anybody complaining because you'll have been because the job you do will be far better than what it would have been without that awareness. I mean, I was in a doctor's office and I knew he was pressured, perhaps that day more than others, because he wasn't even listening to me. Now, I really wanted to say to him, doctor, okay, look, I've got my 10 minutes. Instead of thinking about what happened just before I came in and what's going to happen right after I leave, just spend these 10 minutes with you. You and I'll have a great relationship. You'll still have 10 minutes that will have been spent. It just will have been connected 10 minutes rather than a completely wasted 10 minutes. Here's your script, right? It's like, huh? I didn't even tell you what I was in here for. Now that's an exaggeration, but you can feel that when somebody is being driven and doesn't have time to sit with you, consider you. So this sense of qualitative and quantitative, they can rest together. And I know that because I've worked with it. I've tried it out. And speed is a tremendous incentive for me. So I know exactly when I'm, you know, just when you're moving unconsciously as opposed to consciousness. Sometimes I take a walk and I deliberately start walking faster than I normally would. As soon as I do, I lose consciousness. What comes about from that speed is a whole sense of why I'm walking faster than I need to get to someplace, a whole world view that has nothing at all to do with the walk I'm on. But it comes into place when I'm forcing myself to go faster and move faster than I normally would. Try that sometime when you're just out taking a walk. Now you're going to walk deliberately and walk quickly and give yourself 20 minutes to get yourself back home as opposed to whatever would have been your natural time. As soon as you set a time, you set a speed, you set a duration, and you set a worldview. And it's all from here. It's just all conceptual. And you think, wait a minute, I just made this up. I don't have to go this fast. And suddenly you're back home again. Well, that can be our life. We can be back home again. Now, the last point I want to make on this particular talk is around original action as opposed to conditioned action. Look for opportunities to challenge your action. I mentioned one, taking different directions than you normally would go. Look for opportunities to put yourself a little outside the norm. I often mention in a beginning class to brush your teeth with your other opposite hand. And you'll notice that immediately when you do that, you have to bring a consciousness to bear that you wouldn't have to bring if you were on your right hand or whatever your normal toothbrushing hand was. Why? Because as soon as you throw yourself off like that, you haven't been there before. And what has to come in is awareness in order for it to remind you what you need to do in an unusual and abnormal situation. And as soon as that you've done that a few times, awareness doesn't have to show up anymore. It's been there. It knows it's safe. It knows how to do it. And now it can shut itself into an unconscious mode and continue to move on. So instead of doing that, say, okay, let me just sit for a moment longer than I normally would at the dinner table. Let me just move a little slower than I normally would when I'm going up to bed. Let me read in bed, if that's not your normal habit, as opposed to just turning out the lights and making it uncomfortable for my partner or whatever might be the situation. Let me just throw myself off a little bit, intentionally, with original action. Just to get, okay, and as soon as you do that, you'll see your awareness will light up. And that should be an indication that you're on new ground, untested ground, original ground. Wherever there is behavior that you're frozen within, that you are subscribed to, that you believe in, that you have a massive assumption around, that you have a self-idea about, right? Study it. Study it. Say you feel unworthy about yourself. Study the topography of unworthiness. See what language you use when you're feeling unworthy. See the emotions that arise. Journal it down. Get the details of the landscape so you can get some objectivity to this massive conditioned assumption that comes up and blindsides us whenever it arises. So we just, okay, so let me just, oh God, there it was. So then just take out a piece of paper and start writing about it. So get the data, that's the first thing. Write down 4 or 5 steps that counter that assumption. Instead of going this way and falling and believing that assumption and beginning to withdraw and sort of bodily fold in on myself. I'm going to sit up straight. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to just face the situation as it's occurring. So just write down 3 or 4 steps and then start applying those steps within that situation when it does occur. You're acting without proof. But you're acting much more appropriately, and you'll feel the appropriateness. And you begin to be governed not by proof of the conditioning, of the safety of something, because you won't have done it before, you won't know that it's safe, but because it feels appropriate. And appropriateness will become the guide for how you begin to act, rather than your conditioned reference or historical belief in how you should act. Isn't it more appropriate to look somebody in the eye when they're speaking to you, than to look down because you don't feel equivalent to them or the same as, or whatever you might be feeling, or you feel ashamed or something? So you can just feel the appropriateness of looking someone in the eye. And that's often a good indication that you're moving outside of conditioning. Conditioning often is not appropriate. As I mentioned, it's formed by insane thinking. So when you're doing something appropriate, is this appropriate for me to look down? No. Okay, let me look them in the eye. That's appropriate. It feels right. It doesn't feel right in the sense of emotionally feeling right, because the emotions are trying to fold you back into your assumption. But you can sense that it's a more appropriate behavior. And so you start leading with what's appropriate rather than what's convenient or what is conditioned. So we're just exploring ways to start living Dharma, to start bringing our life within the transformative quality of life itself, rather than to have an idea of how Dharma will somehow affect us in the future. This isn't a future event we're doing. This is an immediacy. This is an involvement. This is a complete living experience. If we want the heart, it's never in the future. If we want the heart, it's never what has been. It is only in the living present. And I welcome all of us into our heart. Can we just sit for a minute or two? So feel the life in our bodies. Let's feel the life in our bodies. It's waiting to be joined. It's not outside of us. It's not something the body is doing and I don't have. If you have that sense that your body is living and you're not, you're on the other side of the veil. What does the word spontaneity mean, except joining it? Energetically joining, surrendering, releasing our objection, and joining it. Scary though it may be. Okay, so there are a few minutes for questions or discussion, if anyone has anything.
Contradiction in trying to recommend surrendering and spontaneity that could seemingly easily lead to reactivity and a falling into what feels spontaneous is to react in a way that you may have insightfully not seen as helpful, but when you are focusing on the spontaneity, felt like the right thing to do.
So the question is a good one. It's about the difference between reactivity and spontaneity, right? Really? Because sometimes reactivity feels like you're being spontaneous, right? You son of a... Well, I was really spontaneous in that. Right? So there's something off. You can feel it already. But we have to go into it. You have to really look at what's occurring in each of those two different references, right? So what's happening in reactivity is that you don't know anything. You're being left behind. It's all muddled. It's all unconscious. You just know that there is, you know, some high volatile emotion that's occurring, and your mind is just exploding on some theme or something. But if you really look at it, you either retrospectively, you'll see that there was no awareness through any of that, that you were left behind. It was just, it was like the doorbell rang and you shot the gun, you know, or the Pavlov's dog. The bell rang, you salivated. It was like, look how spontaneously I'm salivating. You didn't have anything to do with it. The bell rang and you salivated, right? So that's not spontaneity. So what does spontaneity look like? It looks like full aliveness. But it doesn't look like centered aliveness. It doesn't look like ponderance. It doesn't look like, what should I do now? It doesn't look like I'm back here, life's there, and I'm going to consider what to do next. It looks like appropriateness. So you're taking as much of the field in as you are, and the person says something, and that it feels appropriate. And it doesn't feel appropriate. You see, it's hard to say the word appropriate because it feels like you're weighing in on something and judging it. But it's not like that. It's like, oh, what is next said is in alignment with energetically with what was just said from you. Now, I've said this before. This is actually something that I've tuned into a lot. Is I'll be sitting with somebody in an interview, and they'll be saying something, and energetically we're parallel, we're absolutely aligned. And my responses are often things that I would not normally have said, but were very appropriate when I look at them objectively later, very appropriate to the situation. And so there's a kind of an ease, and I was very alive and awake during that discourse, during that discussion. Then I'll be sitting with the same person and my mind will wander a little. And I'll say something from that rather than from the alignment. And it's off. And I can feel energetically that it's off. It's coarse. It just doesn't feel appropriate. It's all like the word just keeps coming back. So I go, okay, let's line up again. And then I rejoin the situation, you see. So I use that sense of a little bit of tension, you know, as to, okay, I'm off a little bit here. I'm off. In fact, if you looked at the tension, the response I gave was often from the tension rather than from the alignment when I was off. And that's really a kind of reactivity, you see. So you can really get a sense of the nature of reactivity and spontaneity from that simple exercise. Much of what we do, I mean, we've all had experience of being spontaneous. Where you say something or a humor or something or other will come up completely original, completely new. Robin Williams was always somebody I always thought was like, that guy is not scripted. You know, he just was some. So each of us have that ability to enter into the spontaneous. Perhaps not as a comedian, but in alignment with the energy that the field of life is offering, and it feels appropriate from the field of that life to be in the position and say the things that you are. Get a sense of that in yourself. Start tuning in to that. At first it's going to be in a kind of an intellectual sort of trying to place ourselves in the right position, saying the right thing. But you'll sense the tension in that. And really what surrender means, and you brought this word up, it's your surrendering the separation. You're surrendering the story that's taking place in that moment between you and the other person. And there's you don't have anything else to go on if you surrender that story. That's why it's scary. But that's the heart of creativity and spontaneity, is right there, surrendering the separation, surrendering the narrative. When we surrender the narrative, we're surrendering the conditioning. And the two things come together in a way that don't when you have a narrative going about someone or about something. I'm trying to offer like practical applications. I've been trying to do that through this whole series. But I don't know, I mean, it would be helpful to know that some of you are doing it. You know, because there is a way through this. We don't have to feel so stuck and irresolute that our life is just moving in front of us sort of a vague fashion and we don't have any response to offer it. You know, this is the Dharma is, it's vertical. It's not time. It's not this way. It's vertical. It's like that. Everything is arising, energy, aliveness, everything like that. Okay, so formal practice, I take. What do we do when we formally practice that supports this? Hopefully you're not thinking. If you're thinking about your practice, then you're not supporting. You are supporting your conditioning. Because the thoughts, which have been conditioned from the past, are coming up to what is being met in the present, whatever is going on in your mind, and you're thinking about, oh, there's that emotion again. I always have trouble with that. God, my back hurts, you know. What am I going to... If it runs off in that reel, then we're not doing a lot. We're kind of living within the karma that's already there. If you're able to hold the space where thoughts can arise, right? Now that space is itself the definition of presence. It's not a thought about the presence, it's the realization and the living of it. And your job in meditation is to bring that aliveness that you may have momentarily experienced in your meditation into your everyday. Right? Not just as a way to relieve some stress or to lower your blood pressure, but to actually change the nature of your life so that it's lived from that vitality rather than about that vitality or towards that vitality. You see? There's only a veil separating us from the seat of where aliveness is. But that veil makes all the difference because, as I mentioned, it feels as if life is something happening to me rather than me actually arising within the life that is. Without the veil, with the veil, so you hear that and you think, I have no idea what he's talking about. That's fine. Incline your mind to find out. You think it's just in some people, it's in the Buddha, it's in Jesus, it's in some other guy? No, it's in every one of us. So I said, wow, that sounds interesting. I'd like to know that. Let me incline my mind towards it. I want that to be my life. See? And then it will. And you'll have to go through all the things that we put in between us and life to deaden it or to defend ourselves from it or to ponder it or to do whatever we do with it. We have to go through all of those things that we have placed, but you are willing to do that because what you want is not the safety of these defense mechanisms, but life itself on the other side. And that's where the inclination will be eventually taking you. No, it's not remembering to be present again and again and again, because that's you trying to do something about the veil you think is between you. It's wanting it. I want to know. You see, the inclination, there is no substitute for intention. None. Effort does not substitute for intention. Effort often binds intention. Rather than just trying to effort your way through, which is trying to show up again and again, which is the way I was trained early on, but which I could never master, because what I was trying to master was the problem of what I was, the problem itself was me. So I said, okay, so what do I really want? You see, you have to go to the basics, okay? What do I really want out of my spiritual practice? What do I really want from it? And it'll take shape around that essential need. That's how it's going to form. So maybe you want to be loving, or maybe you want liveness. I don't know. You know, each of us will form it, the conclusion, in a different way. But once you have that, then you're willing to do anything, including give yourself up in order to get it. And mostly what will happen is that you'll need to give yourself up. In fact, that's the whole journey, is the willingness to release what you think needs to be done in order to be where it's already done. See, we keep thinking ourselves out of the project, out of the environment of reality. So you think, okay, so as long as I'm thinking, I'm out of the environment of reality. What would happen if I was still? That's what would happen. But I don't want to be still. It's too frightening to be still. So let me look at the fear. You see? Let me address the fear. So that's what it looks like.
So it seems like trying to be attentive to being spontaneous, that I should always be suspicious of any kind of infatuation or passion I have about something.
I don't think so. No, that's not true. She said she should always be suspicious of every passion or
infatuation.
Okay, so let's get very simple here. Instead of trying to figure out a way around each of the problems that we've... Let me just be quiet. Let me just be quiet. See what the heart, how the heart responds in this moment when I'm quiet. Find a tremendous passion in quietude. The heart is tremendously passionate. It doesn't look like the passion of the mind. It doesn't look like lust. It doesn't look like craving. But it does look like courage, resolve, vitality. Okay, we have to be quiet tonight.